Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
The bloodiest bloodbath in the history of the Bronx. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you. Where you think the cipher come from? The gods. Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most important figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 114, a talk with Benji Melendez. Benji is the founder, president, and singer of the Ghetto Brothers. He's joined today by his co-author and friend, Amir Saeed. The Ghetto Brothers were one of the largest and most powerful street gangs in the Bronx in the late 1960s and early 70s, a time when the borough and New York City as a whole had plenty to choose from. At its height, the organization had around 2,000 members citywide. But after one of their key people got killed by rival gangs, Benji devoted his efforts to peace and held a now-famous peace treaty meeting at the Hoe Avenue Center in the Bronx in 1971, a meeting that set the stage for the ending of the gang era and the beginnings of hip-hop. Not only was that meeting attended by a 14-year-old Afrika Bambaataa, it was also the inspiration for the big gang meeting in the Warriors.
Can you dig it?
In addition to being a powerful organization, though, the Ghetto Brothers were also a rock and roll band. They only released one album, 1971's Power Fuerza, but it became a prized collector's item, notable for its surprisingly sweet lyrics and Beatlesque melodies, Latin percussion, and unique backstory. The album was reissued in 2012 by the Truth and Soul label. While parts of Benji's story have been shared in the new documentary Rubble Kings, and even in a graphic novel, the book by Benji and Amir, Ghetto Brother, How I Found Peace in the South Bronx Street Gang Wars, is the first place Benji shares his entire life story, and it brought them both to Crosstown Studios in Harlem to talk to us. Just a quick note, for July and August, The Cipher will be moving to a summer schedule where we'll bring you new episodes every other week. Come September, though, we'll be right back to our normal weekly schedule. As I've certainly mentioned before, there's a bunch of stuff you can do to help keep The Cipher going and bringing you great shows like you've been used to. The single most important thing is to subscribe to the show in the podcast app of your choice. That way you won't have to download every new show as it comes out. It'll just show right up. It's also a great excuse to start exploring our back catalog. If you're interested in the Bronx in the 70s, for example, you can listen to episode 79 with photographer Lisa Leone, who grew up in that era. Another key thing is to support us by making a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. And as always, you can find more information about this or any of our other episodes at thecyphershow.com. And now, the only gang leader to ever write a song called Got This Happy Feeling, here's Benji Melendez. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are and who the Ghetto Brothers were?
The club?
Sure, we'll start with the club and then we can go to the band from there.
The Ghetto Brothers Club. Now, remember officially, I did when I moved first to the Bronx. It was 1963 after the assassination of Kennedy. And at that time, the Bronx was beautiful. When I moved to Prospect Avenue, there were four theaters. You know who used to go to Berlin Theater? Batman and Robin. When Batman and Robin first came out, and the Beatles were out at the same time. I remember seeing three movies for 35 cents. But then that's when the Bronx was beautiful. But then I saw when the Bronx was burning with the stores.
You said that happened like 68, 69.
Yes, yeah. Early.
Yeah.
And then what happened, when the Bronx was burning down, I couldn't believe it. What I never experienced in Manhattan happened right there where I lived in the Bronx. And we see all these, you look outside and all you see is red fire all over the place. The Bronx is burning. So what was happening? The place was on fire. Garbage strewn in the streets. Then you started having groups of clubs coming out. Gangs were here. I didn't want to join the gang because I knew that if I was to join them, I have to do whatever their leaders wanted me to do. I didn't want to go that way. I did my own little thing. But then I found out doing things that I thought I would never do. Intimidating people, scaring people. Now, we did things that a lot of the gangs didn't do, and we used to call it outlaw. And what was that? When you become a prospector in my club, the first thing you I have to test you is your warrior. Let me see how tough you are. So you will fight two or three ghetto brothers at the same time. As long as a 45 is on, you have to fight until the record finished. Then after that, you have to live in an abandoned building and stay there. And we took care of your food 7 days to break the fear. Because in the nighttime, you got drug addicts living there. That will scare anybody. And then after that, you get prospector. Once you get the prospector, you get the jackets. You put it on the floor. And everybody urinates on it. If you're lucky, you vomit on the jacket. Then you take go like this and put it on. If that's not bad, you tell me. You know, flies wouldn't even want to hang around you. Nothing. So I wanted to demonstrate to the world that I can be just as bad as they. You know, this is the way Benji runs the club? Yeah. I used to walk around with a 7-inch knife in front of my parking. And every time the cops would come, I would break the knife because it's illegal to walk around 7. So it was 4 inches long. Now, all right, Benjamin, what you got there? Look, it's cut. So put it back in. So where did I get my inspiration from? Hell's Angels.
I was going to ask about that. I know that they were a big inspiration to you, you know, not only in terms of how they acted, but also fashion-wise, in terms of their
look. Yes. I even designed my colors after them.
Yeah.
And they threatened me. They threatened me because they had a skull and a wing. We had a skull and fire. They had white rockers. We had white rockers. They had red letters. We had red letters. How dare me to do something like that? Until finally, word got around. Three ghetto brothers go to the village with their colors on. And they looked and they were seeing some merchandise in the window. They see the reflection of a big dude. Hey, what is this? The guys turn around. Hell's Angels. Take off those colors. So when the guys looked at the corner, the motorcycle guys are there. So they took them off. They come to the Bronx. Yo, Benji, they stripped our colors. Who? Hell's Angels. They said, they here? They're in New York? That's fantastic. 2 or 3 days later, they sent two guys, some allies, some of their allies from New Jersey. They stopped running in front of the Ghetto Brothers club with the motorcycles. Ghetto Brothers around them. What do you want? We'll talk to your leader. Came inside. He said, can I help you? He said, yeah, Alexander wants to see you. Alexander, yeah, the president of the Hells Angels. Let's go. So I went downtown. Rita Fetcher, Dominguez, these are ex-teachers. Right. Or rather, teachers. He's a teacher, 133 Junior High School. Myself, one bodyguard, Valentine, still right next to me. We go down East 3rd Street. What do I see? As soon as I open up the door of the car, you know those wrestlers? Triple H? That's what they look like. I said, oh, man, what am I dealing with over here? Then he's looking at me. Benji, how old are you? I'm 18. You're old enough to die. So Mr. Dominguez was going to say something. Yeah, I can. Shut up. Nobody's talking to you. I said, Manny, please, don't say nothing. What do you want? Your colors. They look too much like Hell's Angels. You put a Hell's Angel here, you put a Ghetto Brother over there.
And so that was when you came up with the garbage can.
But wait, he told me we were going to go on the David Susskind show. If you don't take off those colors, we're going to be rolling up in the Bronx. I'm thinking, yeah, okay. Only to later on when I did research, these guys are all over and allies. So finally, the genesis of the garbage cans came later on. And I think it fits Ghetto Brothers anyway.
So, Saeed, you wrote this book with Benji, Ghetto Brother, How I Found Peace in the South Bronx Street Gang Wars. How did you first meet him?
Benji and I first met through mutual friend Joe Schloss. Joe was having, I forget.
Former guest on the show, I should add.
Former guest on the show, yeah, Joe Schloss. It was, I forget what book it was for, but it was a book launch at Powerhouse. And I had done research for another book of mine, the Beat Tips Manual, book about beat making. And that's how I first learned about Benji. So Joe introduced us. And as soon as Joe came up, I was like, I know you are Benji. And we spoke maybe 20 minutes that night. And immediately, I think it was a Thursday or something.
Yes.
And by that next Wednesday, we were already doing interviews. Like, we immediately said, Benji had told me a number of people had come to him.
Yeah.
He was looking to do it. I was like, let's get it together. And within a week, we were already rolling.
Benji, to kind of jump back to something you touched on earlier in that first answer about, you know, moving to the Bronx in the first place in 63. So you were 11 years old and your family moved from the West Village to the Bronx. You've said that was part of an organized effort by landlords to clear Puerto Ricans out of the West Village.
Yes, yes. They was giving people money to move out. You know, and my father, well, we didn't have to, because he already had a store out there. See, he had a business already in the Bronx. So he told us that we were going to move.
Did you realize that this was an organized thing at the time?
No, it didn't hit me till when I got to the Bronx. When my father said, and talked to me, listen, they paid us to get out of there because they're going to make those buildings new for these other people. So when I go there now, 789 Washington, and I see people coming home, and I said, excuse me, you got porcelain stairs? He said, yeah. Now, when I lived there, it was all wood. You lived there? Yeah, I lived right there, 789 Washington Street, right there. And they had all these modern things that we never had.
Even when you were, you know, before you moved to the Bronx, when you were like 7 years old, you were already a ringleader among kids in your neighborhood.
It's funny, I was a ringleader when I lived in Manhattan, when the Gallaghers used to attack us.
That was the Irish gang?
Yeah, they were right there in Greenwich Village. I remember they had the cops telling us, big Irish cops, all right, move along, get in the middle of the street. I don't want you to go to 10th Street because the Italians are there. And I don't want you to go to Greenwich Village because the Irish are there. But we wanted to play in the park. Until the day when I saw my friend Chael jumping, screaming, holding his buttocks. They whipped him with a barbed wire. And that caught my impression. I felt so horrible that I mobilized the kids around the block because I had a lot of friends. Hey, guys, let's defend ourselves, man. Let's go up there and check this out. We didn't wait for them. Let's go to them. A pre-invasion. So you know what my brother had? My older brother and the friends around the block? They had bicycles. You remember the bicycles? And then the front used to put groceries inside and then you lock it. They took two or three kids in each of those things. They took us to the park. They let us go. We had a whole bunch of rocks. We invaded the area. And that's where it all started. And then I took that. You know where I learned that from? John Wayne.
You joined the Marines because you wanted to fight. Well, you're going to get your chance. And I'm here to see that you know how. If I can't teach you one way, I'll teach you another. But I'm going to get the job done.
Yeah, you said he was quite an idol of yours.
That's
growing up.
That's right. I wanted to be like John Wayne, be a general and attack. I don't wait for them to come to me. Get them now.
What do you think it was about you that by 7 you were already a leader and, you know, leading invasions and all that kind of stuff? What was it about you that made you a leader that young?
The inspiration of that was biblical. My parents used to read us the Bible. Leaders like Joshua, Moses. They said, man, look at the way they ran. Look at the way they ran their organization, the way they ran their army. I want to be just like King David. I want to be just like that. You know, when I see battle plans, where did I learn that from? By watching war movies. I said, we just don't go in there and attack these guys. We got to come up with a strategy. How we're going to get there. So it was all about strategy. I used to read war books. I used to go to the library to read war books. How did they accomplish that? So I knew they were spies. And then reconnaissance. I used all of that idea to overcome those gangs. And it worked. It worked.
And you mentioned, you know, the biblical inspiration. And of course, all of those examples you gave were Old Testament, which gets into this idea that, you know, your family was Jewish, but observed in secret. In fact, never even use the word Jewish.
Yeah.
Even years later when you said, hey, guys, I figured this out, you know, they never used that word.
It was a symbol of shame and embarrassment when I was growing up. I was scared to say Jewish because I thought that by saying Jewish, you're going to get hurt or you're going to get killed. So my father said, shut up. Talk Spanish. That's what we are anyway, so, you know, just, if you don't want to get hurt, keep your mouth shut because words mean things. So I believed them.
And it wasn't until after the disbanding of the Ghetto Brothers in 76, right, that you became openly observant. What made you decide to take that step?
Conviction. Something told me, we're not living in Spain. We're not living under the Inquisition. We're living in the United States. But I remember Rabbi Mark Angel from the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue told me, Benjamin, your parents are suffering from a Spanish Inquisition syndrome. Leave them alone. Show them their respect. You know what the commandment says. Okay. So I never bothered my parents about that. Oh, it's only when my father died that I opened up my big mouth. And my brothers, you know what Papi said? Papi's not here anymore. Come on, guys. He's not here anymore. Let's look at it logically. My sister don't want to hear about it. My brothers do it still on the quiet side. I'm the one who's...
You're the loudmouth.
Yes.
Saeed, what most surprised you about Benji's story, you know, during the process of making this book? I assume you already knew the rough outlines about, you know, he led this gang and then they became political. There was a peace treaty, you know, there was a band.
That's the narrative I think that everybody knows. The thing that surprised me, there are multiple things that surprised me. One, the aforementioned Jewish part of Benji's life, but also how close Benji was with his father. That how the current that ran throughout his life was that he seemed to be completely under his father's command. Even when he was out doing entirely crazy things, he was still conscious of his father. That was surprising. Another thing that was surprising is how long it took him before he lost his virginity. That shocked me, given the time and what was coming at him. So, yeah, it was a number of things that about the story. But also just how round his story was. The narrative that I had already knew about was with the peace treaty and everything like that. I didn't know how far Benji had come. I didn't know how robust his life was.
Definitely. And so, Benji, one of the things I found so interesting was before the Ghetto Brothers, maybe I'm getting the exact wording wrong here, but you were called the Savage Nomads or you were involved in a gang called the Savage Nomads?
No. First, let me tell you chronologically. The Barbarians, Hell Riders, Savage Skulls, Ghetto Brothers, Savage Nomads. Mm-hmm.
And then back to the Ghetto Brothers at a certain point.
Then back to the Ghetto Brothers.
In all of that, names were very important.
Yes.
And you said that actually being in a gang called something like the Savage Nomads or the Barbarians, you found yourself acting more savage or more like a barbarian than you otherwise would.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. If I was to put on a Ghetto Brother jacket, then you was a cool guy. But if you put on Savage Skulls, you got to act the role. You got to act mean, be mean, do mean things. And I wind up doing a lot of mean things. And I said, yo, this is not going to work for me. I was born of that way. But it's funny what colors can do. You know, just the name, Savage. Look at that name, Savage Nomads. That sounds cool, man. And there's another one that I did on my way coming up yesterday. I was sleeping. I was thinking Savage Pirates. Things like that. I come up with crazy names.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's those names that changes a person. You want a reputation. Doesn't make any sense to be a nice guy and have named Savage Nomads. Take it off. Because you got to play the role.
And so the Ghetto Brothers form in 67. And in the early years, you're very open about how you used to actually terrorize people into joining the gang. And so I think people have very vague ideas about street gang life, you know, be it in the 60s or,
yes,
or the 80s, right? They know glimpses they catch from television or movies. Say I was about your age or a year or two younger, and I move in next door to you at the time that you're starting up the Ghetto Brothers. What would you do?
When I first met you, in the beginning, prior to becoming the organization.
Yeah.
You just moved here. Yeah. How old are you? Oh, 18. You're going to be a Ghetto Brother. No, I'm not going to be in no gang. Well, if you're not going to be in the gang, you're not going to have an apartment, because if you threaten that you're going to do something to their parents, which in reality I wasn't going to do. But in his mind, the seed was planted. If I don't join this club, these guys are going to do something over here. Well, he wind up joining anyway. You know, he wind up seeing, man, these guys are not playing. But you know how you can tell? By the colors that we wore, the garbage, the dirt, I mean, the chain. The hair, the hair like this. He said, "Man, I don't gonna mess with these guys." That's what terrified. Listen, I didn't have to do anything physically for them to be moved by the presence that we show them.
So, at one point during the heyday of the Ghetto Brothers, you go back to Puerto Rico for a few months, and you have this jacket that says "President."
Yes,
and you don't bring the jacket with you. You kind of pass it off to a few people. A friend of yours who's wearing it get shot and paralyzed.
Yeah.
How did you feel when you found out that happened?
First, you forgot it was my brother. My brother Victor wore the jacket. He was stabbed 7 times because the guy thought it was me. I was peeing. The news, your brother got stabbed. And I wanted to go back home. He said, no, I was in PR for 3 months. Then Black Joe wore my jacket. Prospect, 130, guy was on the roof with a rifle. Shot Joe right in the spine. To this day, he's on a wheelchair. When I came back, what is the obvious thing to do? We got to get the guys who did this. And you know what I did? It's just 4 or 5 of us got in a car. One car. Went to St. Mary's Park. We just slammed the doors open. And then they looked, oh, man, look, get us. They all started to run. Only 5. You see what I'm saying? I didn't bring the whole Ghetto Brothers. Just 5. Open up the doors of the car. And these guys were running. And we was looking for that main dude. We finally found them later on. Did a number on this. Well, if you want me to tell you the story there, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something.
Yeah.
I want you to listen to this. Bo Dean was the president of the Warlocks. Benji, I can get you synced. I'll bring him to the Ghetto Brothers Club, but you got to do me a favor. You got to kill him. Because if you don't kill him, he's going to kill me because we live in the same building. He said, bring him over. So when he came over, the Ghetto Brothers had their colors inside out. So Bodie walks into the club. We had 2 levels, up here, down here, 2 doors. He walks in, and then Bodie said, this is one of a new division for you. I got to put it together. He said, yo, man, that's cool, man. And then I got up, and he's looking at me, and he's trying to, I've seen this guy before. I went, I was known for this. Like this. The Ghetto Brothers turned their colors upside down. He said, sorry, Bodine, this is Ghetto Brothers headquarters. Lock the doors. He went like this, and I saw Beast looking at me. When I say Beast, you know in your mind, this guy must be a huge guy. That's why I call him Beast. And Big Louie, there was at least 20 Ghetto Brothers in. I went just like this, walked out. All you hear was banging and screaming. I said, somebody's looking. The door opens, flings wide open, runs towards me, holds me like this. Benji, please don't kill me. I'm looking to the side. He had the Saigon knife with the little dragon on the side, right on his rib. So he's hanging out to me, Benji, please don't kill me. So I said, go. That's the Dr. Checo, Mr. Hyde. All of a sudden, I change. Then the other Benji comes in, the merciful one. I said, go. And he goes, yo, Benji, you bronze. I said, I can't do this, man. Then all of a sudden, guys, go finish the job. The guy's right, came back. Benji left, disappeared. Four or five days later, one of the boys comes to the club. Benji Bodine's dead. Satan took him to the basement, gave him a 45, do a Russian roulette. How are you going to do a Russian roulette with a 45? First bullet, have a nice day. Got him. You know what Bodine, Satan does? We were playing in the summer in the Ghetto Brothers Club. All the Ghetto Brothers went out to the beach. Nice day. There was only four of us left in the club. The door opens. I see a shadow on the floor. And when I look up, there was Saint and his boys. They caught me in the club. So I had the post-it, Tato, Diego, Piano. Guys, we're taking this guy. We might not make it here, but this guy is not going to survive. And he says, Saint, told his boys, see, the Ghetto Brothers have rules. No guns, but the guns on the pool table. Sort of shotgun, 38s, zip guns, you name it, they put it right on the table. He walks up to me. He looks at the mummy all wrapped up because he was beat up badly. He goes, hose me. And he said, you know, Benji, I owe you one. You saved my life. This day on, we're going to become allies. That guy could have killed me. He had the opportunity, and he let me go. Now think about that, how many times death was in my face.
And so you were saying, you know, that there was sort of the merciful you and the one who was sort of the hard-edged one. But the gang itself worked like that. You would often be in the position of being more merciful, and Charlie Suarez, better known as Karate Charlie, would be kind of the enforcer in a lot of ways. Things started out cool with you, but they seemed rather tense by the end. What was your relationship with Karate Charlie?
No. What happened is that Charlie moves to Florida. He tells everybody about the Ghetto Brothers. He doesn't mention me. They're making newspapers out of him, all this over here. They made a nice painting about him. But later on, when they found out about this guy called Yellow Benji, and they woke up to him, yo, who's this guy? Yo, he did not like that because I know the whole story. I was the originator of these things. Don't tell me something that's not true. If it is, I'll give you the credit, Sean. I said, you know, you're right. But so in other words, who's putting up dirty laundry? Not me, because I don't know how to use a computer. I don't know how to use it. So when my wife says, oh, Benji Charlie's up to it again, you any reply? I say, no. You know why? I got my brothers backing me up. I got the Ghetto Brothers backing me up. I got newspapers backing me up. You understand what I'm saying? Like he's telling people, I started the Ghetto Brothers colors. No, he didn't. You wasn't even around when that happened. Oh, I started this. No, you wasn't. And about Supreme President, I made him president. I demoted myself to made him president. That's how much I like them. But the Supreme President, no. When it came to any crisis, all the divisions came to me. Proof pudding. If he was the Supreme President during the death of Black Benji, then here's what counts. When I told the Ghetto Brothers, hands down, we ain't going to war. Benji died for peace, and that's it. That's the way he's going to stay.
I'm going to break that down for a second for people who might not know the story. When you say Black Benji, you mean Cornell Benjamin. Originally had the position you guys refer to as a warlord, but you changed that.
I changed that. I told Charlie, I'm going to drop warlords. I'm going to make him peace ambassador. Charlie says, why? The guy is charming, speaks very well with children. He gets along with the adults in the community. I like that attitude. I'm going to change this whole thing. You understand? And the Ghetto Brothers, there was no such thing as democracy. Anything about leadership came through me. Anything about new membership came through me. You understand what I'm saying? You know, it's like my brother, Frankie. Toco Ghetto for the Ghetto Brother album. I was here 2 or 3 years ago. I wasn't here because I was already on vacation. And he walks up to my brother, Robert. Robert, my brother, drives him around. Frankie turns to Robert, yo, what's up with Charlie? Charlie's saying this about Benji, the Ghetto Brothers. Charlie wasn't even around when we were Ghetto Brothers. Your brother Benji took him much later. You see what I'm saying? I don't have to say nothing. Even Charlie's best friend said, his best friend, who he knows, his family and his brothers, I never met. Of all the years you know Charlie, I never met his brothers or his grandmother. No. This guy, no. Mr. Benji, you don't have to worry about that, boy. You got history backing you up. I know Charlie. And, but I love him.
Yeah.
You know, I really care for him, but I don't want to start in a war with Charlie. I don't.
Sure. So Colonel Benjamin Black Benji, you made him a peace ambassador.
Yes.
And the details of this are, you know, plenty of places if people want to find them out. He was killed by some rival gangs.
We came down the stairs, right? And we stopped there. And there was about 13 to 20 of us. And then when we looked down, we seen him. That's when Benji came out, and Benji said, he took a step forward and he said, "Listen, brother, we're here to talk peace." And the guy, he came out and he said, I don't know, he said, "Peace shit." And he like must have took a jump. It looked like he threw a kick, but he must have took a jump to grab a pipe.
Black Benji, at that time, was getting beat up right in the very corner. We found out an hour later, after he was taken to the old Lincoln Hospital, that they killed him.
You got the Mongols, the Black Spades.
And the Seven Immortals.
And the Seven Immortals. Yep. Yo, those are vicious gangs.
Yeah. You hint that you just said, you know, Charlie, Karate Charlie, wanted to go to war to retaliate.
He went to 150th Street and Trinity Avenue, my second division, a very powerful division. I went over there and said, "Charlie, what are you doing?" "I'm mobilizing again. We're going to go to war." "For what? For what?" "No, you're not. You're not going to use the ghetto for that."
Right. And so then you called for peace. And ultimately, you had what became, you know, well known as the Hoe Avenue peace
That's
treaty.
That's right.
Cornell Benjamin, also known in the streets as Black Benji, was ambassador for the Ghetto Brothers. He was beaten to death when he tried to intervene between two other gangs. Instead of retaliating, the Ghetto Brothers convened a peace meeting of all the gangs in the South Bronx at the Boys Club on Hoe Avenue. This event marked a turning point in the history of the gangs as they began to turn away from violence to become a positive force in the community.
Think about this. If I did not sue for peace, think of the consequences. And the war would have been declared, it would have been written as the bloodiest bloodbath in the history of the Bronx. But not only the Bronx, it would have gone through all the other divisions in all the five boroughs.
Well, at that point, you had probably a couple thousand members.
That's right.
Just yourself.
So all the five boroughs of New York would have been in flames. I saw this in my mind. And I said, "No, I'm not going to declare war. That's not going to bring Black Benji back to life."
Right. And that meeting was filmed. It made the papers.
Yes.
Even though we had colors, we were a gang, we'd never look for trouble, man. I could understand if they beat up Benji, but killing him is another thing. You took away one of our brother's lives, man. And we were right down at the funeral looking at him, saying, "I wish the immortals, if they were them, to see what it is to take away one of our brother's lives." You don't want us to become a gang again, right? Because I know you, right? Don't I know you? You was up in the meeting and you told me, "Benji, I want to get out alive." Didn't you tell me that? Benji didn't get out alive. Benji died. They took away my brother's life, man. The thing is, we're not a gang anymore. We're an organization. We want to help Black and Puerto Ricans to live in a better environment.
One of the things that was interesting is it seems like the media was kind of disappointed that you didn't call for this encompassing war.
Well, think about it. They're right there. What did they want to see? They wanted to see news. They wanted to tell America, here's a place called the South Bronx, the jungle, the Vietnam, the Korea. You know, if you want to find death, don't commit suicide. Just go to the South Bronx. What happened there? They wanted to tell America that a bunch of savages live here. I turned it around and I looked at their faces and said, "I'm not going to satisfy you. We ain't going that way." In spite of the fact that we were still wearing our colors.
One of the most interesting things about that meeting is, you know, it got a lot of attention, but at the same time, there was an element of this big meeting that was largely for the media, and the actual work of the thing, you know, seemed to happen afterwards in one-on-one meetings.
The best part was after the peace treaty. When you go to individual presidents and talk to them face-to-face without the cameras looking at you, that's where the peace treaty really took place. When you really look at the guy and say, it's like you go on the phone. You know, "Look, I don't want to talk to you on the phone. I want to see you face-to-face. I want to see what your expression." So when I walk up to them, and that's another thing, they didn't come to us. We went to them and said, "Brothers, is this peace going to last? Let's push it." I mean, Let's not give the man the excuse that we are like this. It doesn't make any sense. You're wearing a Puerto Rican flag. I'm wearing a Puerto Rican flag. You're wearing a Black Liberation flag. You're wearing a Black Liberation. And we're killing each other. We're brothers killing each other. We got to stop this. Think of your mother, your father, your brothers and sisters, your cousins, your wife, your children. Don't you want to live? That was the best part. Because that what you saw there was like the Warriors. A movie, everything was staged. You know what I mean? And I said, Charlie, this is not going to work. I think we better talk to these brothers one-on-one. With no media there. And it would be nice if there was a hidden camera to see us talking with guys that are vicious. Well, you see guys holding guns over here, knives over here, and you have to look over here, you know, and you know, but you got your nerve to come here. And I was there by myself, or sometimes with one ghetto brother. Just two or three of us, that's all. But it was accomplished. Something good was accomplished. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the Warriors. Some people think you were the inspiration for Cyrus and the Warriors.
We've got the Saracens sitting next to the Jones Street Boy. We've got the Moon Runners right by the Van Cortlandt Rangers. Nobody is wasting nobody. That is a miracle. And miracles is the way things ought to be.
Have you ever heard that?
You know, it's funny. When you see the Warriors, and I pointed to, and I say, look at the book that I'm inside wrote. Look at the difference between the two. This is the real thing. When we saw guys in the movie with baseball jackets and colors, we laughed. We never see things like that. When we all saw the movie, the gangs, and they came on, boo, because, hey, man, they're trying to do like the same meeting we had in the Bronx. But it was all a show. You see what I'm saying? You know, that was a movie with a real thing.
Very interesting. And at that meeting, there was a kid, probably 13, 14 years old, you know, very young Black Spades warlord, who hip hop fans would later, he was called Bam Bam then.
Yeah.
People would later come to know him as Afrika Bambaataa.
I didn't know him.
You didn't, I was going to ask, you didn't know him at
that
point?
I knew Bam. That was the guy I dealt with. Bam Bam, him. Not Bam Bam, Afrika Bambaataa. In other words, how should I say it? A lot of the gangs knew me. I didn't know them because I was all over the media. So, no, if you ask Afrika Bambaataa, you knew Benji, the truth, he didn't know me, but I knew him. I knew about him.
You'd heard about him.
Right. He knew about me. For example, when Jet Chan wrote the book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and we went to Hawaii, tell me about the peace treaty. He told Afrika, he asked Afrika Bambaataa, no, you got to talk to Benji. The ghetto brothers put that together. We had nothing to do with that. We were the enemy. If you see him on the film, Rebel Kings, when he said, "Yo, man, this happened," and he told the Savage, he told the Black Spades, "You'll be careful. If they're gonna come down, we're gonna have to rumble."
When this tragedy happened, they went to war and even got many gangs to move against the 70 Motors and the Black Spades. Black Spades wasn't going to back down if they was going to fully get attacked. And then it was the time when the Spade leaders on them said, the hell with it, you're ready for war.
You talked about this media attention that came after the Ho Avenue thing. And this lasted for a couple of years where you were doing all sorts of interviews. You were in the media a lot.
You see, but then they're going to look at it and say, opportunity revolutionary. Fuck it. If that's the way it's going to be, let it be, man. I don't want to keep the center shit. I say, for the sake of my people, I say, first is my people before anything else. Because we could always get a face up, man. And a basement is like when we started, and a basement is where we're going to end up again. Because like I said, in 7 more months, we'll probably lose the center. I don't give a fuck, as long as the Ghetto Brothers still exist.
This coincided with the Ghetto Brothers sort of turning into a more political organization.
Yes.
We'll get to that in a minute. What was that period of intense press scrutiny like? You going, getting all that media attention, that period of a couple of years, what was that like to go through?
What I wanted to do was spread the news that there is hope on the other side, that there is life on the other side. We don't have to there are other alternatives. You know, some people, oh, man, I want to be in the news. No, no. That was the best time to use the media to broadcast what we wanted to say, the message. It's like my brother Victor said when we had to get him on the band. When people don't like to hear what you're saying, put it in a song, then they'll listen. So we use that as a strategy to let the young people and adults to see these guys being what they said. Look at them. I wasn't, oh, you know, no. But it was scary at the same time because I'm exposing myself. Going, that's the guy. This is the guy we got to get. He broke up our gang because of this.
And people, in fact, tried to assassinate you.
Yeah, there were some people that did not like me at all. But I give it to my parents. What's your wife? My parents believed in God. Mind you, my father didn't know I was in the gangs at the time. Only later on when he found out. But my parents are constantly praying. You know why they were praying? First of all, they didn't know we were in the gang. They were praying because we were living in bad condition. Dilapidated condition, burning condition, robbing, stealing, murder, rape. We lived in a virtual jungle, chaos. The cops said they wouldn't walk in the community. That's why my parents were constantly praying, God, protect my children in the midst of this violence. Because that's all you hear. Booms. Oh, somebody got shot. Boom. Uh-oh. Oh, there goes fire over here. It was bad. That's what my parents. 62 years old and I survived the fire.
But that period of media scrutiny had a high personal cost as well. It definitely contributed to the breakup of your marriage.
Yes, it's funny. Yeah. My wife didn't want to be. She was always constantly trying to influence me to get out the club. The truth was she was right. She was right. She said, Benji, why don't you spend time with me? I don't want to marry an icon. I don't want to marry. I want a husband. Because I was constantly meetings. My mom, Malcolm X, always here and there, meetings. Same thing. Meetings with this organization. In the end, as I got older, she was right. I should have spent more and more time with my wife. But at the same time, I want a peace in my community. I don't want my little child to walk down the street and somebody crossfires and murders my little child. No, I didn't want to live like that.
You know, the Hoe Avenue meeting sort of coincided with the Ghetto Brothers taking a more political turn.
Yes.
Saeed, what did you think of that part of the story? Did you learn anything sort of more about the political bent of, you know, when the Ghetto Brothers sort of moved in that direction?
Well, I did. I just want to say one thing. That's another example of the sacrifice Benji made. One of the things I hope comes through in the book is that he actually gave up his opportunity with the Ghetto Brothers band. He didn't approach the band the same way that his brothers Victor and Robert did. And that was the sacrifice that he was conscious about. The same thing with his marriage. So as far as the political background for that, Benji was going through a lot in terms of finding out who he was at that time. And so when he was learning about the community and what could be done, the reality was, for me, what struck me is how fast Benji made the decision. Once he decided that he was going to go on this route, he didn't stop. And usually there's a little bit of hiccups when people make that. But with Benji, once he made the decision that he was going to bring everybody together, you never look back.
Benji, can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, who they were, and your interactions with them?
The first people that moved in my community on Longwood was the Young Lords. And some of my brothers came up to me, yo, Benji, there's a new club around here. They're called the Young Lords. Now, when you say Young Lords, that's a gang. That's not I'm thinking Puerto Rican National Movement or the Puerto Rican Communist Movement. But when you said Young Lords, you're telling me you're a gang. So let me investigate. So I went over there. I looked at the storefront, wearing the purple berets, wearing the button with the Puerto Rican flag and the AK-47. I said, well, hey, this is more politics. And then the newspaper, Palante. Then all of a sudden, I started listening to them. But it didn't hit me. When I was introduced to MPI, Movimiento Pro Independencia, Movement Pro Independence, who later changed to the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. Why did I like them? These guys were professionals. They were teachers. They were professors. They came to the Ghetto Brothers Club and they were teaching us doctrines. They gave us a little Mao Zedong book. They showed us how to put an organization together. And I remember the teacher's name was, who taught us, it was Pizarro, who taught at the University of Fordham Road. He was a very good historian, but he was the one who helped put the Ghetto Brothers structure together. And it was his president, Juan Mare Braz, who was the president of the Puerto Rican Social Party. They were discussing the decolonization of Puerto Rico in the United Nations. So there was a whole bunch of organizations outside the United Nations saying, free Puerto Rico, free Puerto Rico. I see two guys coming out of the United Nations with a bullhorn, Benjamin Melendez. And in spite of it, there was a crowd behind me, tons of people. So my boys, yo, Benji, bro, FBI, I got you, man. You know what I did? I got you one of this. I'm over here. So they said, come with us, please. Then where we're going, just come with us. So the cops opened up the police guard and we're walking through the United Nations. You know what they took me to? I sat down with Roberto Alarcón, the ambassador of Cuba, in the little cubicle. And Juan Mare Braz, president of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, he introduces me to the ambassador of Cuba and says, this is the future revolutionary of Puerto Rico. So I shook the hand of the ambassador of Cuba, who was voicing independence for Puerto Rico at the time. So they invited me to the United Nations. Something good must have heard something that caught his attention for me to be in a place like that.
Prior to that, had you thought at all about independence for Puerto Rico, like before the Independista movement sort of became a thing? Was that anything you were aware of?
Yeah. Yes. I did not go for communism. I was more with Pedro Albizu Campos' Nationalist Party. He was very Catholic, very religious, but very nationalistic. I didn't want to go the communist way. I didn't. I wanted to go with him. So whenever you get time, look him up, Albizu Campos.
Pedro Albizu Campos was a Puerto Rican attorney and politician and the leading figure in the Puerto Rican independence movement. Albizu Campos was the president and spokesperson of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party from 1930 until his death in 1965. Because of his oratorical skill, he was hailed as El Maestro, the teacher. He was imprisoned 26 years for attempting to overthrow the United States government in Puerto Rico. In 1950, he planned and called for armed uprisings in several cities in Puerto Rico on behalf of independence. Afterwards, he was convicted and imprisoned again. He died in 1965 shortly after his pardon and release from federal prison, sometime after suffering a stroke. There is controversy over his medical treatment in prison. In the 2000s, researchers got files from the FBI released under the Freedom of Information Act, revealing that the San Juan FBI office had coordinated with FBI offices in New York, Chicago, and other cities in a decades-long surveillance of Albizu and Puerto Ricans who had contact or communication with him. These documents are viewable online, including some as recent as 1965.
And this was someone your dad had a relationship with.
My father was interesting. He got me excited. And I was saying all these things to my father, of all people. I said, Pa, look, see this picture? This guy, Albizu Campos, but my father's looking, shh. You see that man? I used to iron his clothes and make him food, rice and beans, and oh, yeah, right. He said, you don't believe me? Go ask your mother. So you know what I did? I walked backwards because I wanted to see his face. So, you know, because he might go one of these. But then I said, Mom, stay in the kitchen. Remember I told you about strategy? So I'm standing in the middle. I said, Papi, Mommy, who's Albizu Campos? Oh, that's the guy who used to live where you was born, where I was born. He said he was in the corner. Your father used to had a laundry, worked in laundry. He used to do his clothes. He used to iron his clothes and bring him his food. Even when he was in jail, he used to bring him his food. So Papi knew Albizu. Yes, he didn't agree with him philosophically, but he respected him for what he believed in.
And so during the period in the early 70s, when the Ghetto Brothers transitioned from a gang into a more political organization, I read a little bit about how you guys dealt specifically with drugs and prostitution. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. When the community, the one who introduced me to that really was my brother Victor. I was looking at all these people going like this. And I said, look, Victor, all these people must work hard, man. The people, they're all tired. Ah, Benji, it's called dope. Now, in my mind, dope means you're stupid. That's what I got. Dope means stupid to me. And then he explained it to me. He took a little cap. This is what they do. Then you put it on fire. Then you take the rubber. And then you put the needle. How do you know about that? I do it too. Started to cry. Victor, why you do that? Well, Benji, the only way to stop is you got to get rid of the pushers. That's what's poisoning the people in our community. So I got started to get rid of the pushers. Yo, I did it with strategy. I had at least 20 ghetto brothers behind me. And I would walk up to a pusher. Yo, my man, you better go somewhere else. Don't be selling drugs in my community. Now, he's looking, one guy looking at me. Now, he's thinking, they got all these guys over here. If I say no, they're going to jack me up. So they knew that we had allies, too. They led our community. The prostitutes was diplomacy. You know, they were young women. So we treated them with a little more respect. Young ladies, can you go somewhere else? You got a lot of children living in this community. From that time on, they went to Hunts Point. They stood there. Hunts Point Fruit Market. You see them in the nighttime. I don't know if they're still there because I haven't been there. So they're there. Okay, there you go. They're still there. And then we cleaned our community. We started to sweep. United Bronx parents offered us a refrigerated truck. We gave breakfast for the children in the community. They came out of school. We offered them help with their homework. So we had a lot of girls, smart guys in math, history, you name it, we had them. You know, so that caught the eye of not only the media, the people.
I should note that United Bronx Parents that you just mentioned is yet another link to hip hop. Evelyn, their director.
Evelina Gennady.
Her grandson, Joe Conzo, is a very famous hip hop photographer who took influential early pictures of the Cold Crush and a bunch of other groups. And actually, as we speak, has an exhibit up at the Museum of the City in New York.
I was in the Museum of New York, but across the street from the Museum of Natural History. I was there. But they had my colors there. The title of the was The Gangs of New York. So they had my boots and they had my colors there. And I knew Joey since he was a baby. He used to call me his uncle. You know what I mean? The only sad thing about it, which I know he might hear it through here, I don't know. But the only sad thing about Joey is that he didn't put anything about the ghetto brothers. He knew me. He knew me way before he knew Africa Bambaataa and these guys. And he hardly mentioned the ghetto brothers. After all we have done in that community, that her grandmother used to give us access to her organization so we could have meetings there. How can you forget that? That's part of history. Even Joey said, I didn't know my grandma gave you guys a refrigerator truck and she gave you guys brooms and she gave you guys clothes. Yeah. You know, my brother.
One other thing before we get into the music, which is, you know, the sort of one of the main thing I think that really gives this story legs and keeps people rediscovering it. In the book, you level some pretty big charges about police. And Saeed, I guess I want to start with you about this. Benji says that different cops are paying gang members to bring in drugs and sometimes would arrange for assassinations of other gang members. What was it like for you to hear that and then to include it in your book? Were there ever any second thoughts of like, wow, this is pretty serious stuff to be putting in there?
That wasn't the only time I've ever heard that before. Spoke to different people. And Benji was forthright about everything. So there was things that I would go back, I would cross-reference. But you have to understand, this isn't a new story, the idea of who's bringing in the drugs. Now, when you get into the assassinations and things like that, it's not too much of a mental leap if you have the law authorities controlling a drug trade, would they be enforcing the drug trade? So I wasn't at all worried about whether that was, you know, some false accusations. There's people from his block that I spoke to, and it was sort of well known. What I did keep out was some of the names, some of the cops that were mentioned by name.
Sure, that's fair. Benji, what, you know, without getting into specific names, what kind of evidence did you see for that? What kind of proof did you see specifically dealing with police paying gang members to bring in drugs? Just because that seems, you know, sort of a step beyond even what people might have heard about, you know, corrupt
you
cops
remember
in the
back
70s.
In the days, the cops wanted to find information, for instance. YSA, Youth Services Agency, gave us the Ghetto Bros Club. They paid the rent.
This was a city organization.
Yes. Ted Gross, was the one who's heading the agency. Well, they found him later on. He was assassinated with a bullet in his head. Politics. Then all of a sudden, one of my boys who worked for Fort Apache says to me, Benji, because we had a bone in the club. Look. So every time I would talk on the phone, any future thing that I was sending Ghetto Brothers, they would pick him up the information. But I had a Ghetto Brother that was already working over there. You see what I'm saying? So the cops can be judged. I'm not saying all cops, but they could be very corruptible cops. Remember, that was the time where you could make a lot of money selling drugs. You know, you live in the suburbs, you live over here, but let's make money over here. You understand what I'm saying? But this is not a news, Sean. That was in the news all over the place. Everybody knew that. You know, we experienced it, but everybody knew that. So for in the future, you know what I did? So instead of talking on the phone, when they get a cup, I used to write down the instructions. I showed the leaders. The cops are shocked. They didn't know how, what happened, because I cut communication. When you cut communication, you're cutting something very important. Where did I learn that? The military stuff. Don't let them find out any step that we're doing. Nothing. So everything was written on paper.
Interesting. And so to finally get to the music, the Ghetto Brothers album, I think one of the things that fascinates people about it is, you know, they hear Ghetto Brothers, even if they don't necessarily know the history, oh, there was this, you know, Bronx street gang that lived in this whole culture with, you know, a lot of violence and a lot of intimidation. The songs are often very sweet and romantic, stuff like There's Something in My Heart and yeah. You know, Girl from the Mountain. There is something in my heart that I have to say to you. I don't care if she will bring me sorrow. I've got to see that girl. That gets people's attention. Did you personally see a division there, kind of between a tough side of yourself and a street side, or sorry, a tough side and a tough side of yourself and like a sweet romantic side?
Of course. But watch this. When you look at the Ghetto Brothers cover, like you pointed out, you see leather jackets, you see all that, songs of love. Doesn't make sense. But we were influenced a lot by the Beatles.
In fact, you started out as Los Junior Beatles.
We were called the Junior Beatles, and we opened up for Tito Puente at Ambassador Embassy Ballroom in the Bronx. And we sang all over the place. We didn't know how to play guitar at that time, but we developed our harmonies through Alvin and the Chipmunks. That's where we learned our harmonies, Alvin and Chipmunks. And then from there, we went and we looked and listened to the Beatles for the first time when they came on the Ed Sullivan Show. And we see today, when you see them with the long hair, to me, that's not long hair. You see long hair than that. But in those days, that was considered long hair. And it was an effeminate thing. So in the Hispanic community, if you wore a little, you was considered funny. So my older brother said, yo, there's some guys coming from England called the Beatles, they're a bunch of faggots. I said, why is that? They got long hair. They said, oh, yeah? So then the first time Raymond and I go to Prospect Avenue to his uncle's restaurant, and we saw a sleeve of their album like this with the man. It was a man when I heard that record. I said, I want to sing like that. So we bought the Beatles songbook. We learned all the songs. And from there on, we would call it the Beatles.
So the songs on the Ghetto Brothers record, the songs themselves are kind of, you know, Beatlesque in some ways, like you're saying. But the feel of them, you know, rhythmically and percussion wise, there's a lot of Latin influence in there.
Yes.
How did those things come to meld?
My brother Victor, he used to tell me, look, Benji, I know you like Beatles. I know you like a rock and roll. Let's add other stuff. We could do Latin. Let's add a little bit influence of Sly and the Family Stone. You know, little beats like that. Integrate them. Only to later on, we were doing Beatles songs with congas, some Beatles tunes, with a saxophone. And to know that a friend of ours comes from Florida, California, walks up to me and Robin. Hey, guys, you know, I saw a band out there called Santana. They're doing exactly what you guys are doing. They're doing rock and roll and Latin at the same time, you know, doing this. Yeah. And then when we first heard it, that blew my mind. I said, look at that. We were already doing that already.
I was going to ask about that because, yeah, when I first heard the record, not knowing the exact chronology, I thought, oh, yeah, this does have a Santana-esque feel.
Yeah.
But you guys developed that independently.
Yeah. Now, my brother Robert and Victor like Santana. I was a Santana fan. Why? Because I love when you play guitar, play the whole rhythm, play guitar. You're constantly down here. I never liked that. Like Jose Feliciano, that's a guitarist. Guy plays the guitar, but I told Robin, man, every time this guy does an album, it's the same lead. He said, oh, Benji, give the guy credit. No.
So you said Victor was kind of the musically driving force of the Ghetto Brothers band. Can you talk a bit about his songwriting, his arranging abilities?
Victor was incredible. My brother Victor would sit down one time. Every time we look at him, Robert and I, and we look at him, and we're sitting on a sofa, and Robert said, Victor says, because Robert and him were like this. Robin, I got a new tune. It's about this. Or it's about Benji. There's a song, Watch Out, There Goes That Crazy Boy. So Britta was talking about me. So little did Britta can sit down, and Victor had an incredible ear. He would tell Robin, your E is out of tune. Man, get out of here. It was out of tune. Listen. And Victor would look, he had a habit of saying to me, hey, Ray Charles, because I used to go, ooh, my baby. And every one of the songs, I used to say that. Stop saying that, Benji. Say it one time. Don't do it to every song. So he was a choreographer. This guy was good. Very good.
And you recorded the whole record, Power Fuerza, one day.
One day.
What do you remember about those sessions? Like, how much of the stuff was worked out before you walked in the door?
We practiced in the studio first in Ghetto Brothers Club. Victor said, this is what we're going to play. This is what we're going to do. Matica Chupihala. Have you heard that one?
Yeah.
Matica. Look at the way Victor arranged that song. I mean, cool, the whole thing. It was done in the Boricuas Club. And Victor said, why don't we practice all here? And when you go to the studio, everybody knows their parts already. So we went to the studio. He looks at Marin, the one who got us put the album together. He said, you know how you take time to do an album? Victor said, nah, we're going to do it today. I don't want to wait for it. So we did it all in one day. One is a blooper, though. Got this happy feeling. Was not supposed to be in the album.
Right, you said you made the words up on the spot to that one.
No, well, yes. We had the tune. I just didn't have the song. So Victor said, man, just make up anything. This is just play. Just play. We didn't realize the guy was already recording it. When the guy recorded it, I said, man, yo, I don't sing like that. I'm only playing. We are at too late. We already recorded. Victor said, let it go. It'll be our blooper. It was about my wife. I wanted to sing nice, something nice.
I got this happy feeling inside of me because my boobie's having a little boobie too.
And I blew it by saying stupid things there.
It's funny. You mentioned the song you first mentioned.
Masika Chupihala.
Yeah. That the words, you didn't know what they meant. It was,
right.
It was a drug reference. They kind of snuck in past
yes.
you.
I thought it was about sex.
Right. So can you tell our audience who doesn't speak Spanish what the title literally means?
Masika Chupihala. Masika means to bite, chupa, pull, and hot. Let go. So it was about smoke. I didn't know. Robert told me that. So Robert, you mean, yeah, Victor was talking about smoke. You see, they even caught me off guard.
So that record, for a bunch of reasons, the sound, sort of the mythology behind it, the fact that it never really made it outside of the Bronx,
right.
Wasn't promoted very well, years later becomes a collector's item, you know, selling for hundreds of dollars and, you know, hard to find. And
talking about it, sold one for $1,500.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did you become aware that it was a collector's item?
A friend of mine, you know Joey Gonzo? Mm-hmm. Well, his friend, Johan, bought the album for $1,500. And that's when I started looking. What? They're selling that much? He said, yeah, Benji. And then they found out there are five albums out there that's white, you know, white that they put in studio discos. He said, if you get that, you make a fortune. He said, there are five of them out there. Well, people don't know. We did a soundtrack for a film called Facts About Sex by Sal Gordon. You got to check that out. But it was never released in the album, but it's in the film. All the music that you're in the film was the Ghetto Brothers.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's,
yeah.
That's incredible. You didn't even have a copy of the album yourself after a while, right? You gave them all away?
They gave me a box. I gave it all out. I didn't stay with one. I gave it all out. Stupid.
Amazing. And, you know, one other thing about the band is, you know, going back to the Hoe Avenue Peace Treaty, after it happened, you guys would play in front of your clubhouse. And because of kind of the changed climate, you would have people from all over the Bronx come through to the parties.
To all the gangs, come over here, my brothers. We're having a party every Friday night.
What were those parties like?
It was fun. That's why you have to see Rebel Kings. You see when the guy captures Sean, the director. I captured people dancing in the street. But people had a great time. Then, you know, every Friday, you can see us out there having a ball. And that brought people together. Music brings people together. You know what I mean? And in those days, we were so influential with the music in those days. that girls, the girls that liked us, bought Beatle albums thinking that was us. I said, what do you mean? Why'd you put that album? No, it reminds us of you guys. So when Winnie, I want to hold your hand, she loves you, it reminds me of you guys. It's like the Beatles are singing your songs. Crazy things like that, you know what I mean? But it brought the community together. So what did these gangs do? They brought this sound, the idea of playing in the streets and having parties, to their club.
Right.
And they started to do it there.
Right, which would eventually become, you know, the parties, the sort of famous Bronx Park jams.
That's when hip-hop was born there later on. Because some people say, oh, the girls were the precursors. No, no, we were rock and roll. What we did is like the Beatles, we opened up the door to concert. We started the street singing, all of that. And they brought it to a second level. Remember, when I first saw those guys out there in the street, I thought it was a religious group.
This is, you said the first time you saw breakdancing,
yeah,
you just
I said,
thought it was people catching the Holy Ghost.
Yes, oh, look, the church is out here. No, man, that's what they do. And then the rap, you know what I thought when I heard rap for the first time? You know the guys who do Auctioneer? That's what I thought it was. Brother Victor said, Benji, this industry, listen to what he tells me, Victor, this is going to be a billion-dollar industry. No, it's not. And he died, he was right. Victor was incredible. Oh, my goodness.
Saeed, as far as the book goes, you know, Benji's story in recent years, aspects of it have been told other places. There was a graphic novel. There is, as he mentioned, the documentary Rubble Kings, which we'll get to in a moment. What's unique about the book?
What's unique about Ghetto Brother, How I Found Peace? And this soft rock street gang is that it's Benji's whole story with never before told details. It's more of exactly what he went through. It's more of the composite of the person that he was. Pretty much most other accounts really deal with the whole Avenue Peace meaning, and they try to push hard on this was the precursor to hip hop. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I wanted to make sure and what Benji spoke about in detail was that although he was aware a little bit late, the conditions of the whole Avenue Peace meeting, it made it possible for a little bit more safe passage. Now, whether we link that directly or not, one of the things I think Benji says in the book, it wasn't like people went around and said, we're going to be a hip-hop club now.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it was. But he also mentioned, Benji also talks about how at this time, people started to leave the gangs as well. So you still had street gangs going all the way through the mid-70s, but it was sort of like a first wave of the group. Some of the most vicious people, they actually started not wearing their colors. All of these things combined created a climate for that. So that part of the story is there. Benji's early history, that's what makes the book unique. Benji's life with his wife, you see a man as a father, you see a man as a husband, you see a man going through, he's being split between two worlds. And then also what I wanted to get across for the youth was that all of these things were happening. He was a teenager. So it's a coming of age story.
Yeah, that's the incredible thing. During most of the stuff in the book, he's sort of 17 through 20.
Yeah. Well, even earlier than that.
I guess he was starting at five or whatever.
With the Nomads, he was before that.
And yeah.
Then you have the
and then the one with Bottle the Alligator.
Yeah.
Back in the days.
Yeah. And so you see all these different things in... What I appreciate the most about this story is that it's a true New York City story. It gives you a broad spectrum of New York from the 50s going all the way up through the 70s.
And to survive it, you know, the Henry Chaffont, you heard him?
Yes, of course.
Henry Chaffont paid this guy, Reese, to do my website. So Henry Chaffont gave him all the materials. So I saw him 2-3 days later. So Reese is staring at me. And I'm looking at him and he said, Benji, I read everything here. How the hell did you survive this? This fire. You know what I told him? I didn't want any trouble. Simple. I just didn't want any trouble. You know, when you start trouble, you're going to get it. If you pinch somebody's nose, you know it's going to bleed. You understand what I'm saying? So in the latter years, you know, Frankenstein was started to change his way of thinking. So I had to put a new brain, a new heart. Because I was a mean guy. I mean...
We spent more than 5 years hanging out, getting to know each other, going over things, repeated, going to different spots, visiting. And that's what shows up in a book. There's a heart and there's a pulse of the book. And it's Benji's story instead of people trying to narrate the story. That's what really makes it stand out.
Benji, any kind of closing advice you might have for, you know, the Bronx is a very different world right now. New York is very different. But there are still people, kids in hard circumstances facing the same kinds of pressures that you faced at 7, at 15, at 17. What advice would you have for them?
I've always said this when I go to high schools, when they invite me to junior high schools, and college. Love is a powerful force, but you have to be consistent. I always tell them. The Chinese say the hardest element is rock. Soft is water. When constantly water is dripping in a rock, eventually it's going to make a hole. Consistency. Because when people, young people look at you and you're consistent about something, they're going to believe you. They say, this guy's not joking around. This guy really means what he says. No matter what we've done to this guy, we made fun of him, he's still the same with us. Because you care for that person. Why? I was there. I was there and I've survived this. You might not make it. There is another alternative. Stop that. Look the other way.
Well, Benji Melendez, a.k.a. Yellow Benji, Amir Saeed, the book Ghetto Brother, How I Found Peace in the South Bronx Street Gang Wars. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So the great thing about talking to Benji is it's really a direct connection to a whole other era. You know, if the only thing you know about the Bronx in the 70s is, you know, the Bronx is burning and the Warriors and whatever, it can seem like an entirely different, you know, piece of the past that, you know, is entirely vanished and gone. But the people who were key players are still here and, you know, still able to tell their story. And it was just such an incredible experience to sit down with one of those key people and hear about that era and what was going on and the stuff that he lived through. It was also fun to get his take on some of the fictional representations of the time. We had a good laugh about the Warriors gang, the Baseball Furies in particular. I was glad to be able to talk to Benji about more than just the Ho Avenue peace meeting. That meeting, at least in certain circles, is pretty well known. It's been covered in a couple documentaries and books. And while it's certainly noteworthy, there is a lot more to Benji's story than one meeting that happened to be caught on camera. For more about Benji's era of Bronx street gangs, I definitely recommend you check out Sean Nicholson's new film, Rebel Kings, which is available now on iTunes and video on demand outlets. Benji's story is often put in the context of hip-hop, you know, the stuff we talk about at the end about how the peace treaty led to a kind of more open social life in the Bronx and thus to the parties that would form the backbone of hip-hop. But Benji's story musically is really about the Ghetto Brothers band. Join us in 2 weeks when our guest is the incredible producer Mark the 45 King James. I could tell you all about him, but all you need to know is that he produced Hard Knock Life, Stan, Queen Latifah's first album, and a little instrumental that goes something like this. As always, you can find us on social media pretty much everywhere at The Cypher Show. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, probably some other stuff I haven't heard of yet. Let us know what you thought of this week's show, ideas you have for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. And remember, subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice and make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Also, if you're using iTunes, those ratings and reviews really help us a lot. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
He was stabbed 7 times.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He was very Catholic, very religious, but very nationalistic.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Special thanks to three-time Cypher guest Adam Mansbach for introducing me to Amir and helping to make this episode happen.
It doesn't make any sense. You're wearing a Puerto Rican flag. I'm wearing a Puerto Rican flag.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
That's a Latin for you. You hear it? Ooh! Sorry about that, guys.